Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Holidays in your national parks. That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Giddy up, giddy up, giddy up, let's go. Let's look at the show. We're riding in a wonderland of snow. Giddy up, giddy up, giddy up, it's grand. Just holding your hand. We're gliding along with the song of a wintry fairyland. Our cheeks are.
As you make plans for the holidays this season, check out what's happening at your local national park. We will, following this week's Nature News. So now, the news. 190 nations from around the world began meeting in Bali to hammer out a worldwide agreement to combat the effects of global warming, ASAP. The Bali meeting follows on the now legendary Kyoto Protocol, which, with the recent signing by the new Australian Prime Minister of papers to ratify the Climate Pact, leaves the U.S. as the only major industrialized nation to not sign the agreement. The U.S. pledged not to be a roadblock to the Bali conference, but was willing to join the rest of the world, offering evidence of U.S. efforts to fight global warming without submitting to mandatory emissions targets. The conference will continue into next week, when Nobel Prize recipient Al Gore is expected to arrive. Google, the web search behemoth, has pledged to get into the quest for clean energy solutions with the hopes of providing between 25 and 50% of its energy needs from clean sources in the future. But Google, an innovative giant, is not content to seek out existing sources. No, it intends to apply hundreds of millions of dollars to developing new technologies in the hopes that it will not only meet its objectives, but also become a major supplier of electricity and thus make lots and lots of money in the future. Now that's a great way to think. Good luck, Google. What is the relationship between art and global warming? Is there one? Well, according to scientists in Athens studying the sunset colors of historic landscape giants such as J.M.W. Turner, there may be a relationship. Turner, renowned for his dramatic and colorful sunsets, may in fact have been interpreting the shift in sky colors following the enormous volcanic eruption of Krakatoa in 1883, which blasted ash into the atmosphere and made its way around the world. Sunset colors are very responsive to changes in the atmosphere, and by analyzing the relative amount of reds and greens in paintings over the last 200 or so years, researchers intend to explore the possible record of atmospheric changes based on the changing palette of the artists. On a personal note, as a landscape painter, I can attest to the reddened skies following large wildfires. Some of the most dramatic skies I've ever seen followed the Yellowstone fires. I recall thinking about painting the crimson skies, the endless crimson skies, but thought twice, knowing that I would receive wild criticism for over-dramatization of the effect. Comments such as, "Skies would never look like that," although obviously false, were enough to keep me confined to my usual palette. Perhaps the researchers need to factor in such adjustments into their final analysis. A recent discovery of an amazingly well-preserved dinosaur sheds new light on various aspects of the world of dinosaurs. Preliminary studies of the 67-million-year-old hadrosaur, named Dakota, are already altering theories about the structure of dinosaur skin and the nature of their movements. What makes this discovery so unique is that portions of the dinosaur have been preserved with skin, sinews, muscles, and bones intact. Prior to this discovery, scientists had to surmise about the nature of the musculature. Now they have whole sections of the ancient creature showing the anatomy with great precision. The excavation is the subject of a National Geographic Channel special entitled Dino Autopsy, airing Sunday, December 9th at 9 p.m. Eastern and 10 p.m. Pacific. And finally, if you really care about how you and your decisions affect global warming, One of the things you can do to help save the planet is to save your marriage. According to recent studies released this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a global trend of soaring divorce rates has led to a surge in the number of households with fewer people. The result? We collectively devour more space and gobble up more energy and water. The conclusions are based on the fact that the number of households is increasing faster than the increase in the population, as a direct consequence of the dividing up of once unitized family units. This trend is not unique to the U.S. alone, but rather is becoming a universal factor. So here's this week's best bumper sticker. Save your marriage, save the earth. And that's the news. And now to today's feature. Holidays in our national parks. There's so much to do in national parks literally every day. It would be interesting someday to have a complete listing of all the activities going on in the national parks across the United States. And in this holiday season, you know, there's a lot of things going on in national parks. And in some cases, there's very special and unique activities for the holiday season. And that's what we're talking with Rick Wallner, who is Chief of Interpretation at Bent's Old Fort National Historic Site. Rick, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sidney. Good to be here.
First of all, why don't you tell us about the National Historic Site?
Bent's Old Fort commemorates the story of kind of the United States expansion out into this part of the world. It's a tale of cultures coming together along the Santa Fe Trail and coming together at a place called Bent's Fort. What the Park Service has here today is a reconstruction of the original post, which was built about 1833 in what is now southeastern Colorado. It was built of adobe, so it kind of melted into the earth over the years, but the Park Service reconstructed it in 1975-76. Right on top of the original foundation, so it's right where the original post was, as near as we can get it to what it looked like back in the 1830s and 1840s, when the fort was kind of the center of everything for this part of the world.
Yes, the Santa Fe Trail was the highway through that part of the country for the Anglo, in particular, world that was migrating that way.
Exactly. The trail, the Santa Fe Trail, kind of tied Missouri, which was basically the edge of the United States at that point in time, with northern Mexico, New Mexico, Nuevo Mexico, the northern province of Mexico, and the capital there of Santa Fe. So the freight that went back and forth on the trail between Santa Fe and Missouri really tied those two regions together and tied the cultures together, tied the Hispanic culture of the Southwest to the Anglo culture. And, of course, the trail went through Native American land. So that was also a big part of the equation.
Give us a location.
We're located in southeast Colorado, so we're actually out on the plains of Colorado, rather than up in the mountains, 2 hours east of the mountains, out on the plains, just east of the city of La Junta, Colorado. La Junta is the nearest town. It's 8 miles west of us, and we're located along the Arkansas River on the plains of Colorado. We're about an hour east of Pueblo, Colorado, about 3 hours southeast of Denver, three and a half.
When you're heading west, you pass that area looking west to the Grand Rocky Mountains.
Yep, from the ramparts of the fort, you can look off to the Spanish Peaks in the distance and Greenhorn Mountain and Pike Peak.
Well, this is an interesting time of the year, and what you're going to do is recreate, in some ways, that spirit of that time. Tell us what's happening in the days ahead.
Well, coming up this weekend, we have our annual holiday celebration at the fort. And what we do is try and give visitors a little bit of a taste of what celebrating the holidays was like back in the 1840s. So as they arrive at the fort, they basically go back in time. As they enter the gates of the fort, go back to the 1840s, and they'll come across living history folks, living historians, doing activities that would have been typical of the time, both regular work activities as well as maybe some of the special holiday activities that might have been going on.
Well, give us some specific examples.
Some of the specific sorts of things that would be going on would be certainly the craftsmen at the fort, that is the blacksmiths and the carpenters and the wheelwright, folks like that, were always busy. So the shop will be going, the carpenter shop will be hammering away in the blacksmith shop. The traders.
Do you have a working forge there?
Yes, we do.
Oh, fascinating.
Yes, we do.
Bring your cameras for that. It's so filled with great sounds of the slamming hammers on metal. Oh, that's fabulous. And the smells, too, yeah.
That's right. You get the whole experience with your senses there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sight, sound, smell of the blacksmithing. One of the visitors to the fort wrote in their diary that the sound of the blacksmith's hammer was incessant here at the fort.
So,
it was a big part of the business. Bent's Fort, besides being just an outpost on the Santa Fe Trail, was also a trading post.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bents did a lot of trading with the tribes in the area, the Cheyenne, Arapaho, Comanche, and Kiowa were the main tribes they dealt with. And so winter season was trading season because that's when the buffalo hides were at their fullest. And so traders would load up at the fort with trade goods and go out to the Indian camps to trade and then come back to the fort with the buffalo hides. We'll have that sort of activity going on with the traders loading up the wagons at the fort to head out to the camps and then bringing the hides back. And we have a working fur press in the middle of the fort plaza where they baled up the furs to ship them out. So we also get the fur press going, bale up buffalo hides.
Now, are you going to be doing any cooking?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The people in the fort had to eat, so the domestic staff at the fort was always quite busy. So we will have cooking going on in our fort kitchen. They'll be making a very nice dinner for the fort staff, something that might be appropriate to the holidays. Typically what they ate here was buffalo, so that's what we'll be cooking. Buffalo for breakfast, buffalo for lunch, buffalo for all the time. So they'll be cooking buffalo in the kitchen and serving up a wonderful meal in the dining room to our volunteers. Most of the living history folks that come and help with this are actually volunteers.
Now, do you actually sort of look at this as a holiday event with music and things?
We do. We have frontier music. We have banjo and fiddle music going on. And some of the other things we do that are more of the holiday sort of thing. One of the things we do in the carpenters and blacksmith shop is do toy making during the day. We have sessions where we actually let the kids go in and help put toys together.
That's great.
The toys of the period. We also have a taffy pull that we do. That's something that's been historically documented as happening at the fort were taffy pulls. So we do one of those in the afternoon. We do a pinata break also in the afternoon, kind of representing the Hispanic culture here at the fort. And we do a Yule log hunt, another tradition from those days, kind of lost nowadays, but the kids love going out there and trying to find the Yule log hidden out in the woods along the river. And then we use our ox team to actually drag the Yule log back while the kids, whoever found it, gets to ride on the Yule log.
Well, I can't imagine anything being quite as meaningful as being able to tap into that early American history. Now, this is an event. It's happening Friday and Saturday evenings. I believe a person has to get reservations.
The event actually starts Friday evening with candlelight tours. We'll be doing candlelight tours of the fort on both Friday and Saturday evening. So Friday, December 7th, Saturday, December 8th, starting at 6:15, we take groups through the fort, about 25 people at a time, and they're led by a guide with the candle lantern through different rooms of the fort. And as they go from room to room, they'll encounter people from the 1840s celebrating the holidays as it might have happened back then. So those tours are very enjoyable. You go around, it takes about an hour and 15 minutes to go through the fort. And then after that, we serve period refreshment, things like mincemeat and brandy snaps and biscochitos. So those are the candlelight tours. Those you need reservations for because we can't take giant groups through the fort. We only can take about 25 people at a time, and we do 10 tours each night. In fact, our Saturday night tours, Saturday, December 8th, those tours are already full.
Wow, congratulations.
But on Friday, we still have room. So for Friday, December 7th, we still have room on those candlelight tours in the evening. Then the next day, Saturday, December 8th, the activities will run all day. The park opens at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we'll have activities running throughout the day till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There'll be all the ongoing work, day-to-day work of the trading post, as I say, like the craftsmen's work, the traders' work. We'll have adobe workers working on adobe on the fort. We'll have the cooks in the kitchen, things like that. And then it'll be supplemented by some of those special events that I mentioned, the toy works, the making the toys, the taffy pull, the pinata break. So it runs all day, 9 to 4 on Saturday. No reservations needed for the daytime activities. Just show up and enjoy.
And then December 8th, you continue with more candlelight tours?
Right. The candlelight tours will go again at about 4 o'clock. We'll shut down the park for a couple hours, let the living history folks get something to eat, rest up for the, get ready for the evening, and then at 6 we'll open back up, and 6:15 we'll start running those tours again Saturday night. Like I said already, Saturday night is full, but they can still sign up for Friday night.
Sounds absolutely exciting. We're hearing about some of these storms crossing the country. What's your weather like? What are you expecting, and how should people prepare?
Actually, the weather looks pretty nice this week. As I say, we're out here on the plains of Colorado. We're supposed to be in the upper 60s tomorrow.
Oh, boy.
and then cooling off a little bit for the rest of the week. But they're talking about lower 50s, around 50 degrees most of the way through the forecast period right now. So it looks it gets cold at night, so folks going for the candlelight tour, certainly, or at any time, just dress appropriately for the weather, but it doesn't look like we got any big storms coming.
Now, do you have some sort of big fire outside to keep warm if you have to?
Yes, we do.
We
build a big bonfire right out front of the gate of the fort where folks can gather, and then we also have a nice bonfire going in the plaza as well, so there are a couple places folks can get warmed up, and then the rooms of the fort have fires going in them as well. They were all heated by fireplaces back then. So we've got 19 fireplaces in the fort. Now I'll have roaring fires going too.
We're talking with Rick Wallner, who is the chief of interpretation at Bent's Old Ford National Historic Site. Sounds like a terrific time, Rick. I wish I could be there. For anybody in the neighborhood, or if you just want to make a special day of it, if they want to find out more, Rick, where can they do so?
Well, there's a couple things they can do. They can go on the web, on the internet, at www.nts.gov/BEOL. That's the Bent's Old Fort site, BEOL. And if you click on special events under things to do there, it'll bring up a whole schedule for the weekend and for the activities. If they want to get a spot on those candlelight tours on Friday evening, they need to phone the park. The number is area code 719-383-5010. That's our main park number, and they can get in for more information on the event and get onto the list for the tours, too.
Well, great job. You're doing a great service to everybody by keeping these traditions available for people to experience. There's nothing like going to a national park to do exactly that. Rick Wallner, thanks so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
You're welcome.
In the next few weeks, here are some notable special events happening in the national parks. This Thursday, President and Mrs. Bush will light the national Christmas tree in the nation's capital, December 6th, between 5 and 6 p.m. Martin Van Buren National Historic Site in New York State will hold its annual winter celebration of Van Buren's birthday in coordination with the Village of Kinderhook's Candlelight Night on the evening of December 7th. You can help celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Harry S. Truman National Historic Site in Missouri on Saturday, December 8th. The site will feature the Truman Christmas Exhibit. The Trumans love to spend time with family and friends for Christmas. The historic site offers the complete contents of the Truman home, left almost untouched. There will be a holiday open house at the Fort Union National Monument in New Mexico on Saturday, December 8th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The event will feature artisan demonstrations and Christmas carolers. And for a Christmas Louisiana style, visit the Jean Lafitte National Historic Park on Saturday, December 8th at the Acadian Cultural Center in Lafayette. Children of all ages are invited to a holiday open house from 1 to 4 with holiday treats, an old-time toy display, and story time with Mama Noel, and much, much more. To find out what's happening in your national park, visit www.nps.gov and follow links to your favorite parks. Wishing you all a warm goodbye, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News. We'll be right back.
Thank you.